I'm Jeremy Michaels, and I'm the portfolio committee, at least I'm the secretary to this ad hoc committee, and we will immediately commence with this meeting and start with the election of a chairperson to this committee. So according to the National Assembly Rule 129, we have to elect a chairperson to this committee, and I'll immediately proceed in asking for any nominations. Anyone? Ms. Van Wyk?
Ms. Suchi?
Okay, thank you. Do we have a seconder for that nomination? Okay, thanks. Do we have any other nominations? Okay, seeing that we don't have any other nominations, we I would immediately ask Ms. Suchi to join me and welcome as the chair of this ad hoc committee. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and good morning to members of Parliament and to our visitors from outside Parliament, members of staff and everyone. This is our first meeting in this new year. I know that it was not an easy thing to get politicians from their constituencies to come and be in Parliament today, but well, we didn't have a choice. We are here today, and we are still members of Parliament until such time. Without any waste of time, I will welcome then Deputy Minister Jonita Lange and his team from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. I'm sure that each and everyone has got his or her own program. Jeremy, you did send out the program. And today's mission is to deal with the election of the chair, of which we did. And then the second item is the briefing on this criminal law amendment bill. I as a chair, I've just been elected into this position. So unfortunately, there is nothing that I can say as far as this is concerned. The department will lead us on this, and we will communicate then with other members of the committee. I understand that there are those members who are not here today, who were not informed timelessly about their participation in this ad hoc committee. And as for the processes from here onwards, we'll have to sit down and decide on the dates and also the time frames as far as I'm concerned as a newly elected chair. But at the moment, the only thing that is remaining in order for us to be able to take the process forward is to ask the Honourable Deputy Minister of Justice and his team then to take us through the proposed amendment on the Criminal Law Amendment Bill. I've got a call from the Speaker that I am going to preside over this. I also then asked Honourable Johnny for members of the police to be part of this gathering, because there is a lot when it comes to implementing this piece of legislation. They are the number one role players, so I did ask them to be part of this. Thank you. Over to you, Deputy Minister.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Since I was here, we didn't have smart things like this.
Honourable Johnny, let me miss it then.
Madam Chair, do you think it would not be possible for the Deputy Minister to sit at the top?
Yes, he can sit at the top.
Thank
correct.
You.
You are correct.
I'm going to
do the slides. Oh,
I'll sit there when we ask questions. So I can face the music. I'm trying to hide away. No. Chair, can I firstly thank you and congratulate you with your election. I am absolutely pleased that we're going to be dealing with you when we deal with this legislation, particularly because, of course, it also affects the police particularly quite much, although it affects the whole criminal justice system. The police will be central in implementing, and your role there is quite crucial. For the reason for you coming back to Parliament, members of Parliament, I suppose I'm going to be blamed for it. I accept that happily, because you will see when we introduce this bill to you that it's absolutely vital that we pass this piece of legislation. Literally every day we wait and don't put these things in place, our fight against crime is more and more limited. And you'll see that it's absolutely necessary to do this, because this legislation, the legislative framework, is needed for us to be able to put in place all the processes, the procedures, and the equipment that's going to cost billions and billions of rand to be able to make us effective in our fight against crime. So I do apologize that you are here, but you will see that it's for a very good cause. Chair, you will also remember that when Cabinet passed this bill on the 3rd of December last year, we immediately put this bill on the various websites of the Department of PMG, and in the process we've received 90 submissions on the bill, and we've either sent them to Parliament, well it's actually 95 now, or we are processing and giving them to you as we receive them. Obviously, these submissions we did not take into consideration when drafting the bill. They have come after the drafting. And so already we make all these submissions available to you as a basis for further discussion on it. Then there is also a piece of research that Dr. Lowe next to me did, looking at various countries and how they handle this matter. We do hope that that piece of research helps the committee to understand the issues. And then, of course, there is a team available consisting of at least of three departments which are here today. I'm not going to introduce all of them, but I will introduce some of them. From Justice, our head of legislative drafting, Advocate Rudman, is behind me. He will oversee this process and make sure that you get all the assistance you want. If there are any problems, you could raise with him. The people that will be more daily here helping you is Advocate Johan de Lange. You may know him. He's a very senior member of our department, very skilled in the work he does. And then Dr. Lowe next to me is the one that actually has been driving the process, doing the research and drafting the legislation. And she's been very ably helped by Divisional Commissioner De Toy, who's next to me. He is in charge of all the forensics, the crime scene as well as the laboratories in the police force. You may know him well. His expertise and some of his staff, which I'm not going to introduce, but they are here, that practically deal with the issues, are here to assist you in the process if there's technical assistance needed. Then you may know Commissioner Geldnes very well. He's with the legal division. And he's, of course, going to make sure with our people that the legislation meets all the legal prescripts. Already he's raised a few technical issues with us, which we're happy to accommodate. And then from Home Affairs, because you know that's one of the databases we refer to, we have Acting DG Makisi down there, as well as Mr. Gert Reinecker, and they have expertise around that database. If there are any other departments or staff that you need in the process, we will happily engage them and make sure that they are here or if you need to. And all our resources are available to make sure that you can do this work as soon as you can. May I then turn, Chair, to the presentation? I hope, have we handed out copies? No? I think they can hand out the copies. I know people will read it ahead and then they'll be ready for questions. The background to this is that you will know that in November 2007, Cabinet looked at a review of the criminal justice system and adopted seven far-reaching proposals to, in a very radical and drastic way, amend the whole criminal justice system. We're not talking about one department. We're talking about the whole system. So it cuts across the police, Justice, the NPA, correctional services, and even to some extent Home Affairs and social development and education, where they got a role in the criminal justice. All that is being relooked and reviewed to try and holistically change it. And there have been seven major changes being recommended, and we are in the process of implementing all those changes at once. This bill is just one part of one of the projects that has arisen out of it. This particularly falls under change 6 of the 7-point plan, which deals with the implementation of trying to look at priorities that are in the system and particularly the capacity that exists in each of the departments. And what are the weaknesses in the capacity? This is addressing one of the weaknesses in the capacity. And so we say in implementing change 6, the Office of the Criminal Justice System Reform, which is responsible for the review, has identified as a priority the need to urgently strengthen two pivotal aspects of our forensic crime-fighting capacity, especially at the crime scene, namely a coherent, all-encompassing and holistic legislative framework for the collection, storage and use of fingerprinting and DNA evidence. Those are the two major aspects. And when I go through the rest of this input, you'll see the weaknesses that exist today and that we've identified, and we're trying to bring it in line with other countries that are very successful with crime fighting. What is the problem? Firstly, there's a very high number of perpetrators that are not detected. It's one of the phenomenal things in South Africa. The number of people that we do not even know who committed the crime is very high. And you'll see it's one of the reasons, in my view, is clearly that we do not have this kind of technology to help. If you have what I call real evidence, that is evidence that you find on the scene, blood, fingerprints, footprints, that is the most, all the lawyers here will know, that's the most devastating evidence you can find. Because your client has to explain how those came on the scene of the crime. And in South Africa, we are exceptionally weak with the use of that evidence. We rely almost exclusively on eyewitness evidence. And you know that's the weakest. If you go, I mean, you can now be in an accident. 5 minutes from now when they ask you the statement, you start saying, but did it happen like this or that? Now, 3 years down the line, if you have to give evidence in a court of law, can you imagine? So this is really to try and shift our focus in the criminal justice system so that we can use real evidence and make that more the focus than trying to use eyewitness evidence. And one of the reasons, as I say, is we have a very high level of crime that's undetected. Then we have a high level of cases which are withdrawn before reaching court or whilst in court. Now, all the reasons for that is not the lack of this. I mean, there's also people have certain problems. I mean, you know, if you look at crime in South Africa, it's actually amazing. Go and look at the spikes. Crime is mainly committed on weekends. Starts on a Friday and it ends on a Monday morning. If you look at the spikes, and in holiday times like Christmas and so on, huge crime. And it's amazing, if you have to go and look at one weekend in this country and look at all the crime that was reported, and within a week, how much of those crimes are then withdrawn? People go and then say, no, you know, I reported I was beaten up by my husband or my, you know, by this. And either through peer pressure or whatever, family ties, or people being vulnerable and can't lose those people that they... By a week's time, they start withdrawing those charges. So we have huge withdrawal of cases before we go to court and in court. But part of the problem also is because we don't rely on this kind of evidence. If we had this kind of evidence, we can continue despite not having eyewitness evidence. But we do not. And then, of course, all this relates, relatively speaking, in a low conviction rate in our courts vis-a-vis the amount of cases that are reported. And this underscores the urgent need to promote legislation that will have a positive impact on the investigation and adjudication stages within the criminal justice, particularly at the crime scene level. Therefore, the major and immediate problem the OSG has identified, amongst all the problems and challenges we have, is that in our new strategy to fight crime is our lack of capacity, including in respect of personnel, infrastructure, resources, and even in respect of the lack of the requisite legislative frameworks and other problems we experience at the coalface of the investigation of crime. That is at the crime scene, that is when the detectives take over, as well as in your forensic laboratory. All three of those are your investigation stage that we have to look at. What is the present legal position? Those of you that are lawyers will know that currently Section 37 of the Criminal Procedure Act is the only statutory provision which deals with the ascertainment of bodily features of an accused. In other words, that is the only law that allows us to actually infringe the privacy of people to be able to take evidence from them, whether it be fingerprints or whether it be blood. When you're driving in a car, as one of the famous cases that's still being dealt with in this country at the moment, you draw blood for drunken driving or for other reasons, whether you had drugs in your blood and so on. All those are governed under Section 37, which is an old clause that was drawn up decades ago and doesn't take into consideration all the latest innovations that have taken place. And in terms of this section, it allows the police to take fingerprints in discretionary circumstances. It's a discretion. It's not obligatory to take fingerprints. It's discretion in the law as it exists now. Section 37 also requires the destruction of fingerprints, palm prints, footprints, photographs, records, and steps to take and obtain evidence if the person is found not guilty or if you do not institute a prosecution against them. Section 37 also makes no mention at all of the collection of DNA evidence, since it was drafted long before developments within this field. And DNA actually started in the 80s. This legislation was drafted before the 80s. But it is regarded as the legislative source for the current gathering of DNA evidence. So we'll explain to you just now how we do gather DNA and in what circumstance. Very limited, actually. But when we say what is the law that allows us, we still use Section 37, although it is not suited at all for. And we expect that there will be many challenges as we go along. Now, what we found was, and we've been doing this now for a few years, since 2007, before 2007, looking at this, and what we have found in the area of fingerprint and DNA evidence, we have found that there are major challenges. Firstly, that we do not have proper legal mandate to do the work properly, and so that it doesn't get challenged all the time. Secondly, that we have capacity problems, both in terms of personnel and in terms of equipment. And then we also have systemic constraints. So there are huge constraints that actually stops us and doesn't allow us the capacity and the ability to use fingerprinting and DNA evidence properly. At these three levels that I've identified, firstly, the crime scene, where crime scene investigators work. Then when the detectives come in and take over the investigation, and if they find something when they send it to the laboratories, all three of those are your main areas of investigation where we find weaknesses at the moment. I'm not going to highlight all of them, but for purposes of this bill, I'll try and highlight for you now what are the most important ones. The first thing that stunned me, you know, and I've been the Chair of Justice for at least 10 years, and I practiced law for almost a decade before that, and I've been in this position. I was stunned for the first time in my life when I found out what I'm now going to say to you. When I started looking at fingerprint experts, and I started asking this man here, Mr. Troy Nexon, so all right, now we've got fingerprints and home affairs and this. So we use all. No, 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 he says to me. I said, what? He says, no, 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 no. The law only allows us to use the fingerprints that the police have. So there are three databases in this country, three huge ones. The one is AFIS. That's the police one. That database comprises of 10 different databases, and it has 6.4 million prints in it. And it has, the next line you'll see, 803 palm prints. So you've had 803 palm prints and 6 million fingerprints in that database. We have in that database also what we call latent fingerprints. Those are fingerprints that were found at the crime scene, but we haven't been able to identify. We have 620,000 of those. Palm prints, we have 63,000 latent palm prints. Those are things that were found on the scene, crime scene, that we can't match against the police database. Then we start finding out, no, but Home Affairs has even got a better database. Home Affairs has the fingerprints of 31 million citizens in this country. It has the fingerprints of 2.5 million immigrants. and all that the police cannot access. We have, for some reason in our minds, got it in our heads that somehow when things are collected by Home Affairs, they're not in the police, they're not catching criminals and so on. For some reason, our police don't access. So in law, we cannot access those databases. The second database is, you all know, eNatus. It's the transport. When you get a car license, they take your thumbprint. We have 7 million thumbprints in eNatus. The police have no access to those thumbprints. So that is the first big problem that we've identified, is that the police in law are only allowed to use their APIS system. They are not allowed to use those other systems. Department of Correctional Service, we just point out here, who keep all the criminals, they sent their fingerprints. So the database of APIS already includes those fingerprints. So in summary, that despite the fact that a number of government departments administer databases containing fingerprints, the SAPS currently, due to legal and information technology reasons, and let me just explain the information technology reasons. The problem is each of those databases are now separate. So even if the law did allow us to use them, we'll have to go firstly to then run it through the one system. Then you'll have to go and run it through the other system. And remember, that system was made up for other reasons. And then you can also then run it in the other system. So the first problem we have is not only that the law doesn't allow it, but at the moment, our technology is such that we've not linked them together, and it will take us an enormous amount of time, even if the law allowed us, to go and run it individually under each of those systems. So those are your two problems that exist there. And therefore, for those two reasons, we only have access to the fingerprints stored in the SAPS APIS system, as I said. As a result, SAPS currently has no access to the HANES system of the Department of Home Affairs, where fingerprints of 31 million citizens and about 2.1 million foreigners are kept, or of the eNatus system of the Department of Transport, where a further 6 million, I think it's 7 million thumbprints are collected. The second problem we have is that Section 37 does not make taking of fingerprints compulsory. It doesn't make it. So, you know, we can actually, major criminals could have got away because maybe someone didn't find it wasn't necessary to take their fingerprints at some stage. Even if it is for, say, drunken driving or stealing an apple. If you go and look at many other jurisdictions in the world, there are so many people that get picked up for drunken driving. You run their fingerprint and you actually find out there's a major criminal that has committed. So it's not actually just finding the fingerprint on the crime and so on. It's having a holistic system, and by actually being able to get fingerprints for a whole lot of other contraventions which are minor, that you actually pick up often the major criminals. And that does not exist because it's not compulsory at the moment. And secondly, as I've already said, under certain circumstances, you have to destroy that evidence. And there's a lovely, I'm going to refer you in the judgment of Judge Stain in the House of Lords, where he is very strongly in favor of DNA evidence, where he gives examples, he shows examples, where major criminals have been found and convicted on evidence which in the end they should have actually have destroyed, but they hadn't destroyed it. And had, I mean, I think it's something like 55 murders, 33 attempted murders, a whole lot of rapes, of people where if they had followed the law and actually destroyed those things, they would have never found those people. They wouldn't have had it in their face. The judge used it quite nicely in his judgment, which I've pointed out to you. So those are your two legal problems that exist. Then for some unknown reason which I can't fathom and no one can explain to me, the fingerprints taken under the Fires Control Act and the Explosive Act, which you would have thought are vital fingerprints, are currently not loaded onto APIS. And I'm not too sure why. So, well, I know why, because that law doesn't require you to do it. That's why. So legally, you have a problem there as well. And then, therefore, the manner in which fingerprints are currently collected, loaded onto the SAPS fingerprint database and used, means that a fingerprint lifted at a crime scene will most likely only be checked against a limited number of prints, which is about 6 million from convicted offenders, which have been included in the database. That is the sum total of what we have today. So we do have an extensive fingerprint database, but it clearly has major legal and technological challenges and gaps which doesn't make it as efficient as we should have. Then I turn to DNA. The audit has found that the following legislative challenges. Although the taking of blood samples in criminal cases and the ascertainment of bodily features is broadly regulated with 37 of the CPA, no mention is made of the collection of DNA. There is no legislation in South Africa which specifically provides for the establishment and administration of a DNA database as a criminal intelligence tool. We do have a DNA database, but a very small one. And one of the reasons we've not done it is because there's no law that regulates it. So as we've collected DNA on the crime scene, the limited, and try and match it against what we've got, and you'll see how limited it is, in the process we have collected some, but I'm going to show you a comparison with Britain. It's minute what we've got, because we do not have a law that creates a database and how you will regulate it and establish it. Therefore, we identify that we have the capacity to test DNA evidence lifted from the crime scene against a known suspect. So if you have a suspect and you find, say, blood on the crime scene, then we have the capacity to match those two. And then we have a very few of those which we've matched. We've kept them in a small database. That's the only capacity that we have. And that such DNA tests have provided us with limited DNA database that I've just told you. Our law and forensic capacity does not provide us with the possibility of establishing a DNA database at least containing profiles from all suspects arrested and profiles arising from the crime scene. Now, to show you all this, we made this comparison. Now, in a way, this comparison is unfair because the UK DNA database is the best you get. So we have compared ourselves against the best that there is in comparison. Now, there are two things you must look at here. I don't have a marker here, so I can't show you. The top one is DNA profile hits. In other words, with what we've got and what Britain has got, how does it compare that when we use it, how many hits do we get? And then the second part is the DNA database. How many profiles do we have and have we collected? Now, you can see the stunning figures there. In Britain, the crime scene to crime scene matches, they have 17,000 hits. The suspect to crime scene, which is your database, they've got 182,000 hits in that period, 2001, 2006. Now, this is South African comparison. Crime scene to crime, we've got 66 in comparison to 17,000. And suspect to crime scene, we've got 49. So together, in all those years, we've had 115 hits, whereas in the UK, you have about 200,000 hits. You know, if you're a detective, a policeman, you can imagine how much it affects your work. If you are able, in 200,000 cases, to immediately get hit and follow a suspect, whereas in our case, our poor guys get, in a seven-year period, get 115 hits. So they always have to rely completely on other evidence, on going to find it, with all the other capacity constraints. So you can see how in a system, a legal system, how it affects your investigation of crime and your results in court, just by the capacities that you have in terms of DNA. And now this is even more stunning. These are, the second lot of information is what is kept in these databases. And you'll see The UK, their database, and from 95 to 2006. Now remember, you must add 3 years to that because 3 years have gone since then. They already have 3.7 million profiles in their system. So when you get DNA evidence on a crime scene, and you run it through their system, you're running it against 3.7 million people on profiles. If you look in comparison with South Africa, you're doing it against 55,000. So, you don't have, I mean, I got an F in math at school, but you don't have to actually know math and have to be a genius to work out what the big difference and the problem is if you compare those two. Your chances are like no. Now, in fact, here your chances are. Look at down at the bottom of the page. In South Africa, when we run these things, we have a 0.02% of getting a hit. In Britain, you get a hit every 52%. So every second, case, you get a hit. We don't even get a hit 0.1% in South Africa. That is how big difference we have. All the other details are there. This is just to interpret that whole document. I'm not going to read all of it. I'll leave the bottom. But basically, we're saying that SAPS have a very limited DNA database of 123,000 DNA profiles, of which only 55% represents suspects on its investigative repository. The others are where you found things on the crime scene and you linked it up, is the other numbers. But we only have 55,000 on our repository out of the 123,000, which means that we have a 0.02% chance of a hit. In contrast, the UK have more than 90% of their 4.1 million DA profiles, that is by 206, and therefore they have a 52% hit on their system. In fact, I am very glad I see that the DNA, what are you called, Vanessa? What's Vanessa? DNA project. The DNA, we are very fortunate. We have a DNA project, it's an NGO project. They have made a submission which has been given to you. And I must tell you that with our people working with this issue, Mr. Detoy, and their information, the committee will get huge expertise on these issues. They've analyzed these things in detail. They've gone to the UK, they've gone to other countries. They have really huge expertise. Them and our people have linked up also with Britain and have even had audits done of our system by Britain. So there's a whole pool of expertise when you're dealing with this legislation to actually explain this much better than I can, all these issues. But in her paper, just give me her paper quickly. No, not your research, their submission. Oh, here it is. In her paper, she'll show you. She gives you the statistics where she shows you all these samples and makes actually very careful comparisons with these, particularly on pages 4 and 5. And so when you do have the submission and so on, please look at that. I'm not going to go into detail. I think they'll explain it much better to you. But it's actually quite incredible when you actually see what happens on the ground in countries where you do have these capacities. And so I think that expertise, plus we have in government, will go a far way to helping you with these issues. Let's jump that. I think we've explained that enough. Let's go to the next one. What do we do to rectify this unacceptable situation? Well, what government has agreed to now, after long looking at this matter and so on, we have now introduced this bill which is before you, as well as an accompanying business plan, which has been drafted to address the above shortcomings to strengthen the SAPS forensic crime-fighting capacity in respect of fingerprint and DNA evidence. And in broad terms, the legislation, I'm going to deal in much more detail with it, but in broad terms, it does five things. Firstly, it deals with all aspects of biometric evidence. So we have now, with this legislation, we're coming right up into the 21st century and bring it up to date with the most. I imagine in a few years' time, I've seen there's a whole lot of new developments, and we'll probably have to update it, but at least this legislation brings us up to date where we are now on all biometric evidence. Secondly, it expands and upgrades the existing fingerprint database within SAPS, for example, allowing fingerprints to be kept for all accused, it's compulsory, and to keep such fingerprints. Thirdly, it links SAPS fingerprint database with other fingerprint databases in government, for example, ANUS and eNATIS, and it allows LIAs to utilize all fingerprint databases for criminal investigation. So that is a huge step forward, that legally they'll be able to do that. Of course, it's going to take some time for us technologically to link them up, but once the law allows us, then at least the police can go and run prints individually against all those until we've linked them up. So that will at least give us that capacity. Fourthly, it gives SAPS the power for the first time ever to collect DNA samples, which we call non-intimate samples. You'll explain it. Non-intimate are those samples that the police can collect, and intimate samples is when you need a doctor. Now, non-intimate samples are things like your buccal swab. Those of you that watch movies, you often see the policeman comes and he takes like an ear, looks like an earbud, and they do the inside of your mouth. That the police allowed to do buckle swaps and take hair. I mean, a piece of your hair is all we need. To make a profile of you, we just need one piece of your hair. So those two things police can, for example, easily collect. If it's more intimate things like drawing blood and so on, then clearly a medical doctor will do that. So this bill allows both things to be done. Certain of it to be able to collect by police easily, and others that doctors will have to collect. All of this will then go to these fellows, and they will then make the profile, put it on the DNA database. And then, lastly, it establishes and provides for the management and administration of a national DNA database to include all suspects and crime scene profiles. So for the first time in our history of our country, we're allowing that. Now, the next bullet is very important because, you know, there's no doubt that, like anything in life, it can be abused. And we have to, of course, create as strong and as thorough protections to make sure it doesn't get abused. But one thing we cannot do is we cannot skimp on creating tools to fight crime at the expense because we're so afraid they're going to be abused. That we cannot do. So the second part of it is that we've done, and we want the committee to look at this carefully, and if you feel we need more protection, let's add them, no problem. But that is that the bill, to achieve these objects, we provide strict safeguards and penalties to ensure that forensic materials that are collected, stored, and used only for purposes related to the detection of crime, the investigation of an offense, or the conduct of a prosecution. So it's very, very, I mean, the purposes you can use, it's very limited. Now, I must say what we don't reflect here, and it's something we have to look at, and Dr. Feldman here has reminded me of that, is we also allow in the police legislation under the DNA database the use of it for two other things other than just crime investigation, and that is to help identify missing persons, and I don't know how to put it nicely, but in national disasters sometimes you take 9/11, a whole building collapses on top of people, there's very little left of them. How do you identify the tsunami in, remember the tsunami that hit, not the political one, the weather one, somewhere in Asia?
Huh?
Disaster victim identification. This is the technical term. That you use this to able to if it's possible, to. In fact, if you have to ask me, I would one day say that if this country reaches the level of sophistication development we do, I would hope, in fact, that we actually take the DNA of all people, exactly for these reasons, if people go missing and so on and so on. The chances of actually getting hit of missing people on the criminal database is very small. So although we're allowing it, the chances of you actually getting a good percentage of hits on it is small, very small, particularly if you're trying to look for missing children. Missing children won't be on the criminal database. So even if you say in law you're allowed to use it, it's not actually going to work. So at some stage, hopefully, in any case, I think this database, we'll as a country, will have to look at it more. At this stage, we're just focusing on this with this limited other role that we've given it. It's gone. Now, here is the details of the bill. And I'm going to just run through it. I thought I'll put it in the slide for you. Just to, I know time constraints and so on, this will hopefully will assist you to go through the bill when you're looking at it. Firstly, as I say, the bill provides for a new legislative framework, which basically doesn't exist, and then it also makes various consequential amendments to a number of acts. Following from creating this new framework, clearly it will impact on certain legislation that already exists. Clause 1 substitutes the heading of the CPA to make sure you don't limit it to accused persons only. Clause 2 firstly inserts a definition to clarify, amongst others, new terminology associated with the establishment of a DNA database. So we distinguish between intimate and non-intimate, which I've just explained. The one policeman do, others doctors do. Then we, of course, also have a definition for a speculative search. And that is that if we find say, blood or a hair on the crime scene, we then are allowed to run that against the DNA database. Particularly if we've expanded it, you run speculative searches to see if you can actually get a hit on it. That's the whole definition of a speculative search. And here, of course, the divisional head of this unit, of course, is very much involved and responsible for that. That is why you'll see, and we have discussed it a bit also with Dr. Geldnes, we make specific mention of the divisional head, not because we think and we understand that in legislation you don't want to put particularly job description. But the problem we have here, and it's one that you have to look at, I deal with it later as well, but I want to raise it here. You see, the problem you have is in most countries in the world, your forensic units are separate agencies. You all watch CSI. The CSI is what we're talking about here. The CSI is usually linked to the police force, but they have a separate structure, a separate agency, because you have to, in an investigation, try and keep a level of neutrality and objectivity. I mean, if Pitt gets all his instructions from policemen that are, you know, then you can, the possibilities of abuse become bigger and bigger. Because, you know, it's very difficult for Pitt to say no to Dr. Feldman. When he says to him, but listen, just do this, run that, run this, run that, run that. So that is why in most countries in the world it's a separate agency. Now, we at this stage don't have the capacity, the money, and it's just too big for us to try and create a second separate agency. Maybe in time to come, that is something we'll have to look at as a country. As we've developed this structure, to just take it, create an agency and link it in a different way to the police force. So to try and balance the fact that we're not creating a separate agency, we're trying to give specific responsibilities that only should rest with him, to him, so that you don't blur the lines too much. So when you discuss this issue, please bear that in mind. That is the reason we've done it, is not to try and de-link it. He still remains within the overall police force. But we must try and have some attempts to, and if you can find better ways of doing, please look at it and see if there are better ways of doing it, just to try and make sure that there are certain aspects of their work. The other problem that we have is that this unit, we have found, is just another unit in the police force. So as far as their priorities are concerned, Chair, it's like any other priority. So for example, and I don't say this, I don't want anyone to take this up negatively, but I want to give you an example. We go there to them and we see there's a whole lot of equipment standing there. We ask, what is this equipment? They say, no, this is new equipment to help us with DNA. So we say, why is it standing there? It's not being used. No, because the computer people in the department have not yet prioritized the plugs and stuff that have to be created to be able to use this equipment. So that's just an example. As I say, I don't want to use it negatively, but they are just one of the priorities in the pecking order. So we buy new equipment for millions and millions of rand. It stands there because ISM, which is the same in my department, by the way. My units have got the same problems. They're all treated the same. So when you've got a very urgent thing going and something has to keep happening, working, it's just left in the priorities. So we have this equipment there. We don't have the plugs through which to use it. So it's that kind of, and that is why we've created certain issues here that he must take responsibility for. The head of that unit must take responsibility to create the system, the equipment. In any case, the budget's going to come from Treasury. So it's not being taken from anywhere else in the police. It comes directly from Treasury. And so we're trying to create a way without creating a separate agency and still fitting into the police force, but creating checks and balances, number one, so that there is no contamination or as little as possible as contamination. And secondly, that if you, the Portfolio Committee on Safety and Security, call Pitt to say, but why haven't you done this and this and this? It's no use him saying, but IMS hasn't done this, personnel hasn't done this. He has to have some leverage in the bill to be able to, when you call him in front of the committee, to say, well, I have failed. He can't keep on saying, but it's the rest of the police force that is not prioritizing us enough. Not that he says that, that's what I'm saying. Okay? I just want to make that clear, just now it lands in the newspapers when I say So that is very vital for us. So please, if you can look at that in a more creative way, maybe we haven't done it the most creative way in the bill, but you, at least I've now tried to explain what we're trying to achieve. And maybe, and I've asked Dr. Geldnes also to re-look this and see if there's a different way of us being able to do this better. Clause 2 also inserts a new clause 36B into Chapter 3, which firstly makes the taking of fingerprints compulsory. This is the first law ever that will make fingerprints compulsory, okay? Secondly, it provides for the retention of such samples, but stipulates that it may only be used for purposes of crime fighting. Where fingerprints or non-intimate samples are taken from a person who is not convicted and so on, so on, so on, such fingerprints must be destroyed after 5 years. Now, the 5 years is actually not what was in the bill that came from Cabinet. We, in the bill on Cabinet, we just said, you can keep those samples. The state law advisors, when they certified the bill, they were of the opinion that that will create certain constitutional problems. And to allow the bill to come to Parliament, not hold it up, we said, okay, you put your things in, we will argue in front of the committee what we see. And you'll see later on, I'm going to argue very strongly, that I think this is one of the areas that will be challenged one day in the courts. And I think many parts of this bill will in any case be challenged. But I am prepared, and I'm going to argue later on, why I think it's important that we do not create limitations in this bill that we think could happen, but also equally it could be argued the other way. And in the end of the day, I'm very, very strongly of the view that on most of these issues, we are prepared where there are challenges to go and argue these things in court. And in fact, I'm going to later on show you why I strongly rely on a brilliant judgment by Judge Steyn in the House of Lords when he dealt with all these same challenges, exactly the same challenges. You would have read it in the newspapers a while ago. That decision of his was then overturned in the European court, but that is another story. So at this stage, the law says that those kind of samples must be kept for a period of 5 years. We're going to argue that it should be kept for as long as it should be kept, and not just for 5 years. And then lastly, and this also has been dealt with in Canada, we also allow for the clause to apply retrospectively to any convicted person serving a sentence at the time of commencement of the act. So where there are no fingerprints, to allow it retrospectively. Obviously, the usual arguments about retrospectivity is going to be raised. I want to point out to you that the courts, I've always negatively looked at retrospectivity is where you retrospectively create offences. Clearly, you cannot create offences that should have happened, should have existed in the past, and then find people in the future. Of course, we all agree with that. But retrospectivity here is not that. This is people that have already been found guilty, where we may not have fingerprints on them because it used to be discretionary, that this law allows you to take it retrospectively, the fingerprints. Okay, that's all it does. Thirdly, Clause 2 inserts a new Clause 2C to provide for police powers to take body prints and non-intimate samples for investigative purposes if there are reasonable grounds to suspect that a person has committed an offense and if the police believe that the prints or samples or the results of an examination thereof will be of value in the investigation by excluding or including one or more of the persons. Now, this clause is very important. It's actually in many parts of the world they have this. This is the example where people, there are a lot of people on a crime scene. For example, at the party or after the crime scene, members of the public arrive on the crime scene and there's possibility of contamination. People walk around, footprints, they touch things, fingerprints, they exit, their hair could fall out. Now you find all these things on the crime scene. And how do you actually then make sure that you either include or exclude these people? Because if you find a piece of hair, you don't know who it belongs to. So what this allows is in that situation where you find those kind of crime scene scenarios which could have been contaminated, it allows you to take those people that were found on the crime scene and be able to then draw this. Because you have got no evidence of them having committed a crime. But at least you have to try. And what happens in most instances, of course, they exonerate. Because then you can exonerate. you say this piece of air, fine, we don't have to worry about this. This person, someone that arrived late on the scene and was there looking or trying to help, the person was busy dying in a car crash or at the crime scene being stabbed, try to help. Now their fingerprints are all over this person. How you try and exclude that? And so this is not for investigation purposes as such of the crime. It is to try and make sure that you exclude it. Remember earlier I showed you all those latent fingerprints and latent palm prints? Remember earlier when I showed you? It may very well be that some of those latent fingerprints and palm prints is exactly this type of scenario. People that were found, things were found on the crime scene, fingerprints. But because you didn't take the people's fingerprints who were possible witnesses or on that crime scene, you can't exclude them now. So you keep them in your bank because you found that fingerprint on the scene. If you had this clause, you would have been able to immediately remove all those fingerprints from your latent database, and they wouldn't exist. And you will only keep the fingerprints that are there, really, that are possibly are linked to a suspect. Clause 3 amends Section 36 of the CPA in order to ensure that prints and samples taken under this section are no longer destroyed. Well, we told you those issues. Again, we emphasize that provision is made here and throughout the bill for strict penalties to apply should prints or samples or the information derived from such samples be used in any manner or for any purpose other than those stipulated in the bill. And as I said, if you can even make it stronger, that's good. Prints and photograph images taken under Section 30 will be retained and stored. Mr. Madasa, your advocate Madasa, would know that one. This you always get in every court case in the High Court. The only thing you do get is a set of pictures, of the most gory pictures of all the bodies and what happened. Now, that is all being retained. We're not changing anything about that in the law. It remains the same. Clause 4 and 5 merely affect certain consequential amendments to Sections 212 and 225 of the CPA. Clause 6 firstly inserts a new Chapter 5A in the Police Act, in order to deal with the storage and usage of fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images. Remember, the law made it discretionary, and it didn't allow you to keep all that. So we have to expand that capacity for the police to be able to do that. Secondly, Clause 6 also inserts a new Chapter B in the Act in order to deal with the establishment, administration, maintenance, and use of a national DNA database for South Africa. We call it the NDDSA. In other jurisdictions, provision is often made for the establishment, management, administration of a DNA database in terms of separate legislation and under the auspices of an agency. In specifically deciding to incorporate the DNSA within SAPS, provision has been made in the bill to ensure that these specialist functions fall under the Police Officer Commanding Division, Criminal Record and Forensic Science. This will ensure that full accountability rests with the official responsible, and that delivery in accordance with the legislative provisions are not compromised. I've explained that. And as I said, this may not be the best way of doing it, but let's try and then find a way of doing it. The one thing is we can't leave it that for reasons of contamination or for efficacy that it stands on its own. Whether it's linked to the commission or whatever, I don't care, but we need to find a way to make sure that we can hold the head accountable if things are not happening. He cannot hide behind the fact that he belongs to a bigger organization that has many other priorities. The bill provides that the NDDSA consists of 5 indices. Now, this is very interesting. This is highly sophisticated. I mean, if you look at these databases, they're not just nyanga, nyaga, nyaga little databases. They are very carefully constructed, and certain types of information are kept in different parts of the database and can be used for different reasons. You can't always use it for it. So the first index we create is containing a DNA profile loaded from bodily substances found at the crime scene. So the first one are crime scene ones. There where we find evidence on a crime scene, we load those profiles in the base. You remember it was the second, just now when we showed a number of, it's the second one that we had on the list just now. That's the second. The one we call the reference index, it's all the DNA loaded from samples taken under Chapter 3, which is of suspects. So every suspect we pick up, like we take fingerprints, we now can either take a piece of their hair or a buccal swab. Or if we really want to depending on how much information we need, blood being drawn by a doctor and so on. So that is your second list, which you will remember, we've only got 55,000 in South Africa. The British have got more than 90% of theirs, 3.7 million. Then you get the convicted offenders, those people that have already been convicted. You know, you want them in the firm, because we've got high recidivism in this country. Say, we can get a database of all the people that have already been found guilty. That alone will help us tremendously, because we've got high recidivism and the chance of us getting hit is good. Now, we don't have that at all. So that third one is very vital. We can do that one quite quickly by, firstly, you just go to the prison. The law now allows us, we can go and take hair from them and start creating samples of all those persons, particularly the ones that have committed very, very serious crimes, and then later on the other ones. The fourth one is a volunteer index. Apparently in some countries of the world, exactly for the reasons I raised, the other two reasons, because some people actually see the merit that if their child disappears, or, as happened, many people, children are adopted, 20 years later, you don't know necessarily, or people are kidnapped, children are kidnapped, 20 years later they found. How do you actually find out who these people are, where they come from, and so on? So there's a lot of the system that create a volunteer index and allows you to load on that volunteer, which is not necessarily linked to the criminal stuff, but it's linked to the missing persons and their natural disasters, that at least they know that they will be able to identify because they have voluntarily given their DNA for it. And then the last one is, of course, all personnel, contractors, and suppliers. You also take their DNA, because clearly on crime scenes you would want to exclude them from the. I mean, if some DNA is found on the scene, a hair of Pieter Tooi was found on a crime scene, you would hope to God that he was not the one that murdered the person. He was actually there collecting the stuff, and one of his hair fell out because he wasn't wearing his dookie. He wasn't wearing his, you know, those kapi, the kapi commando dookies that they wear, those dookies. Now, that is what the fifth index is about, is to exclude those people that are working on the crime scene and so on. And then the bill requires the National Commission of SAPS or his or delegate develop recommended standards for quality assurance, including standards for testing the proficiency of the laboratories and the forensic analysis. Now, here we want, of course, those directives from the commissioner, but we, in any case, in the Criminal Justice Review, are drafting a whole lot of things to help that. We are drafting a lot of protocols around crime scene investigations, what it is we want people to do at crime scenes. We're doing protocols for detectives. We're doing protocols for their forensic laboratories and so on. Because, you know, when we've actually, and I'm going to say this, I say this thinking, having thought about it, you actually find that there's a lot of chaos there the way things work. If you try and look at the links between mortuaries and the forensic people in health and the forensic people in sex, those protocols are not really existing. They don't work well. In fact, we've now found that a lot of the health look at blood, right? Blood alcohol. So drugs, whether you've got drugs in your blood and so on, that is the Department of Health's response. They've got a separate forensic unit. They look at things like DNA, fingerprints, gun ballistics, the chemical, drug chemical, seeing if this is Mandrax or whatever. That's what they do. So firstly, we've got two separate things that do this. So that's the first problem. Then, of course, what happened is at some stage, police gave mortuaries to health. Mortuaries are not a priority in health. So now you're creating huge problems when police used to be responsible for mortuaries, whatever the difficulties were. At least, you remember that each person that dies unnaturally, there has to be an inquest and so on. So there's a line of how you do it then. Now, the mortuary is somewhere in another department. So the fact is that resources are not being given there. There are no protocols how it moves from health to sex, all these things. So they're in a big respect. There's a big problem there. So those things, over and above these instructions, directives, we're saying to look at standards. There's a whole lot of things we're trying to make uniform through protocols and so on, that everyone knows that this is the way you do it. At the moment, you talk to one person, they do it. In fact, there are three health health laboratories. One here, one in Joburg, one in Pretoria, one in Cape Town. The three of them have got completely different programs and standards. The one works like this, the one works like that. We've now had to get, all of you will remember Alan McKenzie. We've drawn Alan McKenzie in to go and do an audit of all these stuff and try and get us to try and uniform this stuff. So over and above those problems we have is the linkages and how we're working are really a disaster. And people are challenging this more and more as your links, whether your lines of control have been followed, all those things have become problematic. And because we have it in separate departments, it's very fragmented. So you're really having, I mean, like I said, Department of Health, these are only 50, they have only got 58 people in that unit, 58. And in the mortuary, they've got a few people. So in the big health department, there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. That thing is not important at all. So you're getting big, big problems with fragmentation and so on, which we're trying to address separately from these guidelines through a whole lot of protocols, which we'll report back as we go along. Some of them we're actually quite advanced in drafting them. We're even drafting one now on the problems we're experiencing with rape and sexual offences. I mean, that there's no way that we, there's no uniformity, there's no way that we're doing this. So we're drafting through Lisa Betten's unit a protocol to try and do that. So I'm just trying to give you extra information around this, that there's a whole lot of stuff that needs to be fixed up, which we can do in other ways and not necessarily in the legislation, which we're already doing. And we'll report back on it. The bill also requires that the National Commission of Police must issue national instructions relating to a whole number of areas. That is just, again, good practice to try and develop norms and standards so that each policeman doesn't work out their own way of doing it, is that there's a uniformity of how to do it. The justice people will know we do this often in our legislation also to try and Clauses 7 and 8 affect consequential amendments to the firearms control. Remember I said firearms. We don't keep the fingerprints of people with firearms. We're allowing that now. And then with explosives, even more important, we don't keep those prints. We're allowing the police now to take prints and samples in line with the new provision, also when they're busy investigating those two pieces of legislation. Now, this is the issue I raised, is that in the certification process of the bill, the certifiers suggested two amendments to the bill that Cabinet approved. The first one I've addressed to some extent already, and that is the issue of that in cases where people are not found guilty or when you've taken samples and we don't proceed with the prosecution. And often, remember, these people are not found guilty on technicality. In those instances, they felt that the evidence should be destroyed. We engaged with them as a department, and the compromise was really that they felt at least then we shouldn't keep it for longer than 5 years. My view is, and still is, that you know, only one institution in our constitution has the right to decide whether something is unconstitutional or not, and that's the Constitutional Court. Even the president, any other court, judge in another court, no one else can find that something is unconstitutional. The only institution allowed to do that is the Constitutional Court. And whatever we want to do about this, we from Justice are saying that we are prepared that where this bill is challenged, and I know this bill, Chairperson, is going to be challenged, obviously. Criminals are not going to like this, because this is going to be a major tool for them to for the police now to catch them and so on. So they're going to come and challenge not just this aspect. They're going to challenge most aspects of the bill. They're going to challenge whether you should be able to take DNA. They're going to challenge that whole crime scene procedure we've created. They're going to challenge this. They're going to challenge how long you're allowed to hold it. All those things they're going to come and challenge. I have no doubt about that. And in the end of the day, we're saying, well, let that be so. Let us get as much information about what the law is. Let us create the best balances in the law and make sure that as far as we're concerned, that they are not unconstitutional. But one thing we cannot do is anticipate what the court's going to find, because that the court has to do. We can only try and make it as clear and as in our view of what the law is, as constitutional as possible. And I think I'm prepared on this one. to definitely, if I don't have to do it myself, instruct people to go and fight this on court. Because I think there is a necessity. I particularly would urge you that we've given you the two copies of the MAPA judgment. We've given you three things. We've given you this set of research that Loretta's done. And then we've given you the MAPA judgment. Now, the MAPA judgment is exactly this point was attacked in that court case. It was just broader. It included fingerprints. It included DNA, and it included what they call cellular samples. I'm not too sure what it is. It seems something more advanced even than DNA. It's called cellular samples. They challenged it on the basis that if a person not found guilty and so on, you should destroy them. Then in the House of Lords, which is your highest court in Britain, Lord Steyne, which happens to be an ex-South African, who is now an exile, then wrote the most wonderful judgment. And I think all the kind of things that we argue when we argue a limitation of rights, he's argued it perfectly in that judgment. So I'm not even going to go through it. You can have a look at it. It's quite excellent. But I'll read one or two things to you, just to show you the kind of approach he takes, which I think is the correct one. The use of fingerprint evidence in this country dates back from as long as 1902. In due course, our advances of forensic science followed, but the dramatic breakthrough was the use of DNA techniques since the 1980s. The benefits to the criminal justice system are enormous. For example, recent Home Office statistics, now listen to this, this is amazing, if you compare it to South Africa, show that while the annual detection rate of domestic burglary is only 14%, when DNA is successfully recovered from a crime scene, this rises to 48%. Now, all I can say to you, 14%, we don't even reach that in this country with domestic burglary. In fact, we get halfway. In this country, we probably about a 7% conviction rate on domestic burglary. When you start introducing DNA into the thing shoots up close to 50%. Because most of us know that burglaries that take place where no one is there. So you've got no eyewitness evidence. So if you don't collect real evidence on the scene, whether someone drank some water while they were stealing it, had a glass of water, you find their prints, plus their saliva on the glass. You just need that. Immediately you've got something. The person, for some reason, cuts themselves, there's a piece of blood there. If you don't look for it, you don't see the blood, you're not going to find it. Those things is exactly then what starts pushing up, and you get it from ordinary burglaries and so on. As I say, we've only got about 7%, they've got 14%. It shoots up to 48% in Britain. It is, of course, true that such evidence is capable of being misused and that court must be ever watchful to eliminate risk of human error creeping in. But as a matter of policy, it is a high priority that police forces should expand the use of such evidence where possible and practical. And that is the approach, really, that underpins our approach as well. We're just using now this judgment, which came afterwards, after we did these things, to actually support what we're doing. And later on in the document, this particular issue was raised, and the very eminent justice very much found when he said here, in considering whether keeping prints and samples of people not convicted by a court of law is discriminatory, Lord Steyne reasoned as follows with regard to the finding of objective justification to treating such persons differently to those never required to give a sample or a print, although the latter had also never been convicted by a court. At paragraph 54 and 55, he says, if contrary to my view it is necessary to consider the justification for the difference in treatment, I would conclude without hesitation that objective justification is established. And he gives his reasons for it. And so I would urge that when looking at these constitutional issues, and please, if you need more work done from us, we'll do it and do the research and so on as well. If you need or want to question us further on this, we're happy to do that. But at the moment, as things stand, we are expecting challenges, but we are also quite sure that we can go and put up an argument before the court why we should justify and why this should be done. And then lastly there, I want to say that actually, again, in Steyne's judgment, please look there. He gives you examples of where evidence like this that was kept remember I said earlier, has led to huge amounts of conviction of really serious, I think it's 55 murders, 33 attempted, and a whole lot of rapes. I can't remember the figures. But he then shows there and says, but, you know, wouldn't it be stupid for us if we can, these are the results we get from keeping this, to actually get rid of it? I mean, why would we want to do that? If all this is justified in actually taking DNA samples in the first place. So we would on this issue urge you that when you look at the bill, you would find that our officials will be arguing that we should not limit it to a 5-year period, but we should put no limit on it at all. The second change that has been made, we don't feel too strongly about this one way or the other. I don't think that the reasons that the law, the state law advisor have raised are necessarily correct, but I don't think much hinges on this issue. Remember I explained to you that volunteer index, that there are people everywhere in the world that actually volunteer DNA, for all the reasons I've raised. Now, what the law advisors are raising is that if a parent has volunteered the DNA of their child, when the child was, and when the child reached 21, they want to give the right to the child to actually remove the DNA from the volunteer base and so on. As I said, I don't think much turns on it. It's a volunteer index, and you're putting it there for the state to use if you and your family have problems. So, you know, if you want to remove it, well, remove it. So I don't think much turns about it. So the only amendment they suggested is just to say at the volunteer index that you can, when you reach 21, you can remove it. So we're not, that's fine. We're not arguing against or for it. It's there. Now, the benefits of strengthened forensic crime-fighting capacity, I've listed just 5 here. I think you can think of many more. A DNA database and expanded fingerprint capacity are important crime-fighting intelligence tools, particularly in crimes where detection is generally low, such as property and violence-related crimes, and can lead to a significant increase in suspect-to-suspect crime matches. The United Kingdom, we just showed you, when they use it in property, it went up 16, not 41, but actually 48%. DNA scene-to-scene match help identify patterns of criminal behavior that may help solve past, existing, and future crimes. I must tell you, this is one of the big weaknesses in our investigation capacity. You know, we have at every police station, we have detectives. And we have 91 crime scene units throughout South Africa that serve those detectives. And we have, how many forensic labs? Four police forensic labs, 3 health forensic labs. That's our full capacity. Now, the problem is, there are very few places, if any, where people try and pick up patterns. And because we don't collect fingerprints and DNA, we almost do not have a capacity in South Africa to pick up patterns. In fact, one case was brought by one of the senior detectives recently to us to show where purely incidentally, another policeman asked him about a certain criminal when he used to work in Snelspruit in Pretoria. And he said, no, but I remember this fellow. He phoned these people there, and they actually started unraveling that this guy has been a kingpin in terms of committing crimes all over the country. Because the problem is, if you come and commit a crime in Cape Town, and let's say you hijack, then you go and hijack in PE, then you go and hijack in Durban, no one picks up. You have 5 different hijackings, but no one picks up. There's the same people, the same guns, the same balaclavas, the same vehicles that are being used, because there's no way that they pull these things together. There's no way in our whole criminal justice system that we try and pick up these patterns properly. Some of the units they've got at the police, the one that Commissioner Skitter works with, they do some of that stuff, but I don't think it's at the level that it should be. So this will help us to start picking up patterns of people that actually are starting to use technology and commit crime at all places. When you're working, you only look at your little patterns in your area. You're not looking. For example, it took so long for us to pick up some of these serial rapists. You know, that's a taller fellow and so on. It took a very long time. If that guy didn't do everything in the Gauteng area but started raping in Durban, in But imagine how we would have probably not picked it up, because you would actually be scattering that information. Luckily for us, it was in Gauteng, and we were able to, after a long time, pick up this pattern and pinpoint it on a particular serial rapist and serial killer. But these abilities, we do not have them to the extent, and this will help us, this technology. Well, I've explained that. And then, of course, the one thing about DNA, plea bargains and guilty pleas shoot up. I think in Britain, the figure is it 90%, Vanessa? Or is it 80-something?
85.
In Britain, once you've got DNA, 85% of cases they plead guilty, or they come for plea bargains, because you're dead in the water. Any of us that were lawyers under the apartheid regime, I'll use a small little example. When you went to court, and Mr. Geldmeis and them brought these video recordings, your client says, no, I didn't throw stones. I was standing there watching all these kids throw stones. When you come in court, they show you that video. There's your chappie right in front with the biggest stone. You're dead in the water as far as your court case is concerned. Because there's the evidence. The same thing with DNA and fingerprints. Once you put that there, the lawyer says, listen, Buddha, there's a few things you haven't told me. You better start talking very quickly, because the only way we're going to get out of this thing is with a plea bargain. Now, this thing has been proved anywhere in the world. When you've got DNA, a proper DNA system, it just shoots up. And the amount of work then that policemen and prosecutors have to do less is enormous. It takes enormous loads off your system, because those cases are sure cases, and you get rid of them quite quickly. It should also be borne in mind that fingerprints and especially DNA are not used only to prove guilt, but also to prove... Now, this is very important. This is very important. When people argue against DNA, one of the strongest arguments for DNA is that it proves people to be innocent. If any of you ever want to do some reading, go and read in the United States how many people that were given the death penalty and were on death row have actually been found completely not guilty since the introduction of DNA. Because what the police did there, which we haven't done, is when they collected the DNA evidence, they actually kept it. So 20 years later, or, you know, for example, clothing and stuff, they kept it. So 20 years later, when DNA and new technologies come, they then take those things and they actually say, okay, let's look at it. And they found huge numbers of people that... In fact, there's a great book by Grisham. It's actually a true story that he wrote to show how DNA particularly is used in many cases. And there's NGOs that exist in the United States where they actually use this to prove the innocence of people because of the kind of prejudices that are in their system and their jury system. The only thing that you can really rely on is your DNA and your fingerprint as real evidence, and as scientific and neutral. And then importantly, when we are expanding and strengthening our tools of crime investigators and detectives to detect perpetrators, obviously this will help us, those three areas I've mentioned, crime scenes, forensic laboratories, and detectives. This will give them tools to be able to do their job properly. Then I must also say to you that we do have an implementation plan, which the police and everyone has drawn up. We've engaged Treasury with this implementation plan. Money is being committed for these, because clearly you're going to have to create huge capacities within the police, equipment-wise, and new capacities that don't exist now, but also, of course, in terms of personnel. And those are being looked at, figures of close to 5 to 8 billion rand are being talked about. If we pass this bill, it'll probably cost us 5 to 8 billion rand to put all these into place. But that's on board. Treasury is on board. They bought into this. And we just have to fine-tune with Treasury these plans and so on to make sure that it will happen. So we've even done that part of the work. Lastly, just to say that those are the three main areas, just to remind you at the end of the input. Those are the three main areas that we're wanting to make changes. Firstly, to expand the police's powers to take fingerprints and biometric materials. So first, expanding their powers. Secondly, to link the three databases of fingerprints and allow the police access to them. Part of the budget I just spoke of is also looking at IT to link those three together. So it's not just for DNA. The budget that I spoke about, the $8 billion, will also be to create IT so that the police don't then have to go. The police will just put a fingerprint in here and then it will run through all three systems and juke Bob your uncle. If it's one of the citizens of the, one of the 31 million, then you'll pick it up. If it's one of the 2.5 million foreigners, it'll pick it up on honors and so on. So part of the money is for that. And then thirdly, to create the DNA database. So as I've said, Chair, I hope that the information we've provided you with, if there is further information you need, we are happy to help you find it. Most of the staff here are going to be staying with you and help you as far as you need. If at any stage you feel you want to put further matters to me or to anyone else, we'll make ourselves available. And particularly if there are arguments around, I think the only debate that there is going to be around this, if I look even to some of the submissions, is that some people are raising some human rights issues, that we're infringing on human rights and so on. If there's further work that needs to be done in that regard or our views be given, we're happy to do so. But we are happy that the way the bill is, that we will have no embarrassment to go and argue in front of the Constitutional Court. Thirdly, I wanted to say there are some areas already I've discussed with some of the officials here this morning. There are some technical areas that we can tighten up in the bill. So Mr. Gelmes has raised two areas with me which I can't see any problems with. The issue I've already raised of the divisional commissioner, I think. So there are some technical areas we can definitely tighten up. I think in the end of the day, we really want this bill to be exemplary in terms of the capacity it creates for the state. And if you look at the research that was done, you'll see that we have looked at what happens in many of the countries in the world. And we've tried to create a piece of legislation that incorporates all the best practices from those, which we feel at least passes constitutional muster in our country. So those are the issues, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm sure most of them, my staff would have to help. But thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister. That was a very, very good briefing to the ATO Committee. You raised many things that has been a concern to the Portfolio Committee on Safety and Security when it comes to the capacity of our own members that are employed within the forensic lab. You said that you try to retain that skill, but from myself, I am seated as a chairperson. We need to recruit that skill. We don't have that skill within SAP. I have a pile of complaints from the very same people who are employed in that field, that feels that we need more skilled people within that. Now, looking at this bill and issues that have been raised by yourself here, I seriously now agree that in order for us to have a good bill like this one, in order for us to be able to implement it, we'll have to have that kind of a skill, because it's a huge responsibility that has been attached to the police. So we expect the police also to get training now and then on these issues, because there are many legislations, huge amounts of funding has been used by Treasury to the police on some of the legislations, but we had problems when it comes to effective implementation of those laws. But I think this one is one of the best, as per your briefing now, issues that we need to assist the police to capacitate them, actually, when it comes to their investigation level. So I think I will take questions after. We can just break for 10 minutes just to have tea, and then after which then we'll have questions from members of parliament. And we do have also researchers from the cluster here within our senior researchers from cluster. I hope they're also listening. They're also going to assist us. And after everything, we will call for public submission as the ATO committee. We'll send out adverts for people who would like to come and make submissions, but the time will be very limited because we don't have time. And then after which, then we are going to go through there as an ATO committee with yourselves, of course, and see what is it that you need to get right before we decide on passing this. Ms. Sitton?
Thank you.
Chair, just a question. What time limits do we have? Because as I understand it, this is on the program for next week. So I don't know that we've even got time for calling for...
As I have said that, I've been told that I'm going to chair this, so I did take that with the speaker. Time will be given to this committee.
So we won't have
to do it. Time will be given to this committee. So we'll know before next week. They will give us time.
I think I saw the latest program.
And in terms of next week, I think it's
third. So that gives you 2 weeks. But that's just the latest parliamentary program.
You are right, because I proposed the third before I thought that we'll invite people's opinions. But at the later stage, they said, I'd rather advertise instead of inviting.
Okay.
And then it's obvious that we'll get extra time. Okay. Ms. Cohen, Advocate Madalsa, and Honorable Smith, let's just take those. And then after which then we'll take the second round of hands. Ms. Johnson?
Thanks, Chair. Just on the issue raised by the Deputy Minister, the retention of the samples of persons found not guilty, that five-year period that the State Law Advisor is now proposing, would it be possible to, if not today, but then maybe at a later stage, maybe get an indication from the Department what the position would be in other jurisdictions? Because at first blush, the 5 years might seem a bit limited. If we could maybe just get a sense of what's in other jurisdictions.
Fatima?
We don't use this venue in public enterprises, so... And I wanted to just seriously object, Chairperson. You know, some of us have to put our hands up before the Chair recognizes us. I see there are some different types of protocols going on. People just have to wink at you and stuff. I just wanted to pose the following questions. The first is around the other countries and what they do. Are there other countries that allow their police to share the information or the databases in other departments, such as Home Affairs and so on? I imagine that in many of these countries that you studied, you already have quite a substantial database, whether it's DNA or fingerprint or whatever it is, within their safety and security portfolios, and there's really no need to do that. And I just wondered if there were examples of a constitutional state that does that, and where does that get done? And then the other issue also pertains to the destruction of information. Are there countries that don't destroy the data that they've already recovered, despite the fact that people have been found not guilty or that they've served their sentences and a substantial amount of... I see that you were talking about the United States keeping certain evidence and so on, but are those databases also just bolt on? Because it seemed to me that there's substantive merit in keeping a database. I mean, this isn't a punishment. It's not part of your sentence, and it's not part of proving you guilty or whatever it is. This is information that is kept as a reference. It's a research tool, so to speak. So I just wanted to know what informs some of these practices, and whether there are jurisdictions that just build on and don't ever destroy.
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, obviously, this is the... Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to build on the last question.
I think this is going to be the crucial area as we deal with this bill. I think, as the Deputy Minister indicated, in the absence of a law that requires everybody to have samples taken for one reason or the other, so if certain people's information is kept, even though they are no longer facing criminal charges, it's going to be a problematic area because they will ask you why is their information kept without their consent when the purpose for which it was collected is no longer in existence, in the absence of a general law that requires everybody's information to be kept. Even though, as the last speaker already pointed out, that there may be no harm in that, but people will argue these things at an abstract level. But having said that, I'd like to share from the department, as the Deputy Minister knows, that you know, when he has put a very compelling case, and somehow he has to anticipate challenges. And he has put it very broad, in broad terms, the anticipated challenges of constitutionality, and then to which he said he's prepared to face those. But I think at a committee level, we need the department to help us to get to more nitty-gritty about this. Obviously, as you are drafting, you have anticipated the problems. So I would like to hear, what are the possible areas of abuse? For example, I'm just thinking off the cuff that maybe evidence could be planted if information is kept somewhere and for some reason, you know, the police feel that this criminal has been very elusive, and we know that he's a criminal, but we can't nail him, and we have this piece of hair of his kept somewhere, in one case where he was discharged. And here is a similar modus operandi of a crime, and it fits his profile. And he's got his hair kept somewhere, you know, and evidence can be planted. I'm just thinking off the cuff. So I'm just saying there are probably other areas where evidence can be abused. I think it's much better if the department is forthcoming to us, because maybe we are going to hear this from other people. But I'd rather hear it from you first and indicate, having told us, what preventative measures you have taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue, you know, I'd like to make a comment, and it seems to me that about 20, 25 years ago, fingerprints in particular were sent to the forensic laboratory for purpose of sentencing. So you get this SAP 69 back saying, you know, these are the crimes which the accused has been convicted of. But it wasn't a tool to trace someone. It wasn't used as a tool primarily. So you will find all these laboratories and purposely built institutions which had a particular function, whether it was trying to prove that the alcohol concentration in the blood was more than 0.08 at that time or 0.05, is somewhat different in the mind shift. We're now using that as a tool to trace a suspect. And I think that's probably why we find ourselves in a position where the information is fragmentized and not used as a global tool or global, let's call it, investigative center to establish where someone finds himself to arrest him. But the second issue is, I think it touches on what Mike Madan said, and that is, what is the argument against the fact that the DNA or the certain body evidence is kept or has to be destroyed after 5 years? Because it must be a compelling argument to say, and you know, I haven't read the judgment, to say that you may only keep this evidence for 5 years, all these evidence, let's call it, for 5 years, because you know, in the process, victims' rights have been abused, and there must be a total, well, there must be an equal balance in the approach to how far do you use certain evidence to, you know. But
what is the argument against the or for the destruction of that evidence after 5 years?
I will give to Deputy Minister and his team to respond to those few questions, after which I'll take the second round of it.
I think the questions all really turn on the same issue, and that is the issue that is going to be one of the issues that I challenge. I'm honestly of the view. I've been in the Justice Committee for how long and in the Department for how long, and it's a pattern. Any new law you bring or any new innovation or anything else that's going to help clearly gets challenged, and the courts have to go through a process where we then at the end have to find. I mean, the Bail Laws went through that process. People came here and told us the Bail Laws are unconstitutional. Went through the process, the Constitutional Court found they constitutional. Minimum sentences. When we brought in minimum sentence, everyone says unconstitutional. We went through a process, Constitutional Court on two occasions now found that's constitutional. Minimum sentence for children is now in front of the Constitutional Court. So I think we have to realize that our Constitution allows us certain rights, and in a new democracy, we have to keep on pushing the boundaries in law to find out where they are. So I have no doubt in my mind that this legislation will be challenged on a whole lot of grounds, not just one. The first thing people will raise is, should we allow DNA at all? And I think the courts will say yes. Then people will say the different ways that you do it. Is it allowed, isn't it? I think in most instances. I think the one area there's been a debate, and we must just remember it's a very short, small area of the bill. Because the vast area of the bill is that area where people are being charged, have been found guilty. That's the vast area of the bill. And there's no dispute about that, on that issue. It's on the issue that once you've gone to court and they found you not guilty and there are samples, what do you do with those samples? It's a small little area of the whole thing. In fact, this one is going to take long for anyone to actually challenge it, because our database is so small, it's going to take a long time for us to build up a database, and one of them one day may be found not guilty, and then one day they'll find out that they're still on the database, and then they may challenge it. This is something I foresee. I think there are going to be a lot of other challenges before this, because I think this is a very small little issue. Having said that, this research document will give you a lot of the things. I mean, on page 36, for example, we deal here with in which countries must you provide a sample. This is just within the United States. Not even all the countries. 12 states of the United States want you to, when you're arrested, to give a sample. 50 states require that convicted sex offenders provide a sample, increasingly expanding police also to other felons. 46 states require that all convicted felons must provide samples. 11 states to date specify certain misdemeanors even you must give samples. There are 28 states that include DNA from delinquent juveniles in the dark, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see that depending on a country and a state, that there are various degrees to which they allow it. This is just the United States. In Australia, on page 31, you'll see that three states in Australia don't actually only want you to keep samples, but even if you're found not guilty, they still keep the samples. So there's one example already of what you've asked in this regard. Then also on page 36, there's a whole lot of countries here, states in the United States, the research we've done, where the retention of information as samples are dealt with. In 38 states, statutes that detail expungement criteria and procedures. In 35... Any case, let me not even go into all this detail. Look at this research. If we need more, we can give you more. But the most prime example of this was Britain, of course. These court cases are all about that. The judgment by Judge Steyn about the British position, and then the judgment of what the European court found, which is, I don't know who the judge was, this case here, both these cases deal with this issue. In Britain, there was a person who was found not guilty, and he then challenged these issues. So, as I said, in this stage, and the DNA project can help you more, this stage, the trendsetter on DNA is the United Kingdom. They've got the biggest one and the way that they've expanded. There, they very much kept all these samples. And as I said, it is actually stunning, and maybe you can find it for me, Lorette, stunning that passage of Judge Steyn, where he looks at and how many cases actually they were able to find major criminals guilty on the basis of that, keeping samples of people where they were not found guilty. So just in a nutshell, you'll find a wide variety of ways that this is dealt with in all the countries. Britain, as I said, was your main one. If you go through America, if you go to Europe, it's very fascinating to see to Europe. The reason, and I haven't studied this judgment all that clearly, but from my reading of the judgment, is it seems to me in Europe, one of the reasons that they've actually decided the way they've decided is that they have a particular convention in Europe that deals with data protection. And that data protection convention, particularly Article 8 of it, is actually quite specific. It says you cannot keep that data. So, I mean, their convention actually prohibits the keep for Europe under their thing. And then there's an exception created to it. In their section. Now, go and read that for yourself, and you'll see that that has a big influence on why the court overturned the British position. Because Britain clearly is of the view, and they must have forgotten that they signed that convention. But their view is clearly that they've wanted to keep that. But in the end of the day, in any case, whatever we do, we are going to have to justify it, and the approach is going to be different here than anywhere else. Because we have got a constitution, and particularly your right to privacy, your right to equality, your right to human dignity, I think those are the three grounds people will use, then to challenge anything they want to challenge. And we as a government will have to prove that the limitation clause allows us to do what we want to do. And as I say, if you go and read all that I can do, and I read all the judgments that come from the Constitutional Court, I read the whole lot, and I try and read them as many times as I can. So I do understand the thinking and so on. And in the end of the day, you have to find a way then to say, looking at all those criteria that are used to look at when you limit a right, whether we would want to wonder than this. And I think that there are more than enough reasons, not least of all the crime problems we find in this country, why it would be completely foolish of us to destroy, particularly of serious criminals, any samples that we have of this, build them up, spend a lot of state money on this, and the person may or may not be put on trial. The issue in the end of the day, as judge, as I read to you earlier, that judge Steyn said, he said that it is of course true that such evidence is capable of being misused, and that court must ever be watchful to eliminate risk of human error creeping in. And I would add, not just the courts, we as a legislator need to make sure that in our legislation that we create strong sanctions. I mean, if any person misuses us, for example, to plant evidence, I mean, that person should have no mercy and should be treated very seriously and go to prison. I have no doubt about that. I mean, I read on the newspaper on the weekend that some policeman, which I have my doubts about whether it ever would have happened, but let's assume it happened. That some policeman doing a charge told the people to change the name of the accused person. If those things happen, there shouldn't be a debate about it. That policeman should be, the whole law, every bit of it, should be brought to bear on that person. Anyone that manipulates any aspect of the law, and particularly if you're in a powerful position where you investigate people's lives and you can create great problems in people's lives, if you abuse that position, you must clearly be dealt with in the severest terms. And we here as a parliament must make sure that the checks and balances are there as far as we can, and we must make them as strong as we can. And in the end of the day, when we do our oversight work and things, if these type of things happen, we need to clearly come down strongly against such people. We want people that are professional and do their job properly, not that go out and use their position for vendettas or to try and, you know, plant evidence and so on and so on. But, you know, that could happen in any situation, whether you've got this law in place or, I mean, for any other reason. If you want to plant something, if you want to plant hair or pit the toy on the crime scene, you don't necessarily have to collect that in the DNA project. You take him into questioning, you take some of his hair at some stage, and some say you're going to put it on the crime scene. You don't have to have the DNA. So if you want to be a crooked policeman, you'll be a crooked police. You'll find ways of doing it. What we must do in this legislation is put the strictest sanction and censure if it happens, and we must try and look. And one area I've already raised, the one area I'm worried about, I am worried about, is it all right to compare this bill with other countries of the world? But in other countries of the world, these things are usually an agency that stand on their own, and that the contamination can't. I've already raised with you that I'm worried the fact that our one, we're not creating an agency. We're not right ready for it. We just have to try and create the basics, maybe sometime in the future. But that is one area that I'm worried about. I mean, you know, if you just one police unit amongst many police units, and all police procedures and the line of control all applies to you, then clearly if you ever have to have an agency like this that sometimes have to act neutrally from the police and not be used by the police to actually strengthen their case against a particular accused person, then it would be much better if you have the separation. So we have to build in some, even if it's a, what do you call it, Chinese wall, even if we just build in a negligee there, a little thin little wall there, as thin as a negligee is, at least if we build that in, then at least we're starting to create, at least, and we're aware of the issue. And then clearly the portfolio committee needs to come on in their oversight work, needs to regularly engage this and make sure that, you know, there is a bit of a separation. And then to try and do the work, I mean, clearly it cannot be on the instructions of a police commissioner. So, you know, so there is those type of things we have to build into this year. So I fully agree. The possibility, just like Judge Steyn said, that there could be abuse in anything that we do, of course exists. Our job is to try and minimize it and to put practices and procedures in place to try and deal with that the best we can. But in the end of the day, all these issues, as I say, we must try and not let all the debate on this bill be dominated by this. Because this is a very small aspect of the bill. The vast majority of the bill deals with people that are really in conflict with the law and that haven't been found not guilty or not charged. This little part we're dealing with is a small part. In the end of the day, I think the 5 years that the state law advisor, I think the state law advisor's position, if I stand it correctly, is they don't want us to keep this information at all. But I think when we engage them, they then put the 5 years there. We say, okay, try and make a compromise. We'll say you can keep it for 5 years. But they can, you know, they can give their own reasons for that. I just think that, to be honest, I need to put their position. They were not happy about this, and they felt that there will be a compromise. And, of course, they very much rely on, they've looked at interpreting the our Bill of Rights and the Limitation Clause, and clearly what happened in the Marple case, of course, in everyone's mind affects you. I mean, if that court says so, why will it be different here? So I think that, and it is a debate, and we must answer the thing. All I'm saying is, in the end of the day, I think there are good arguments other side why we should be keeping it. Judge Steyn has given the best examples of why, and I think that I will ultimately want, where we put this point to the question, I would like the Constitutional Court to tell us we're wrong. And if we're wrong, I'm happy to accept it from the Constitutional Court. But I think that in the way that I analyze our system, as I analyze in practical terms our criminal justice system where we find ourselves now, and the law, that if we allow for these things to be kept, I think it is the best thing to do at the moment. Maybe in 10 years' time, when things are more stable, we've got a better functioning criminal justice system, we can start looking at being very innovative about how we do these things. For example, the Human Rights Commission. Actually, one of their arguments is, well, why do you include all crime? Why don't you just include serious crime? It's a valid question, because some other countries in the world only do include. But other countries in the world, you must remember, are Sweden.
Yeah.
That, you know, when a crime happens there, people have heart attacks because they're not used to it. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that happens. And so on and so on. So you have to look at your different levels of development, where you find yourself, to actually say, you know, do we push... You know, the issue of human rights, although there are principles involved, it is also a very practical issue. The bar, where you put the bar. Of course, in a country that's stable like Sweden and so on, you will, your courts will very well maybe put the bar here. But in another democracy, when you look at it, you still, on a matter of principle, can put the bar at a certain other level. And what I'm saying at the moment is, where we find ourselves in our criminal justice system, as fragmented as it is, as challenging as there is in the system, I would want us to put at least obstacles, actually, to the police. We've never given them these tools. Now let's give it to them, let's use them. And in the end of the day, if there's one area where we've maybe gone too far, well, okay, then I'm happy for the court to tell us. But as I said, it's not going to change anything, and it's not going to affect any conviction, because the person we're talking about here are people that have already been found not guilty and on the system. So it's not going to, if the decision goes another way, it's not going to affect us as such. It's just going to minimize some part of our pool we're then going to have to remove from the pool. At this stage, let's keep it in the pool. It's going to help us better. Thank you, Chair. I hope if they allow, I think this question of, I think a lot of these questions, I really would ask that, Chair, at some stage you make a chance to talk to the experts as well. I mean, our people just here from Home Affairs, they've been to some conferences recently, amazing, looking at what's happening in the rest of the world, and who shares this information and how they share it and under what circumstance. I think all that detail can be given to you. But on the whole, it seems to me that the way it's done, it's mainly done like our bill. You know, the clause we've got, which says, but you can only use this for purposes of crime detection, investigation, and prosecution. I think Britain and most countries have that clause, to make sure that when the police have to collect this information, then clearly the purpose has to be for a very narrow purpose, and not start using it when you want to see the DNA of your girlfriend's latest lover, and you want to try and see where their whole line comes from. You start using it for that kind of thing and see how you can put a voodoo on them and so on. Clearly, the police shouldn't be using it for those reasons. It has to be strictly and then, as I say, in many of the databases, you have this voluntary index, where they do use it then for reasons that we have missing persons and disaster identification. Those two examples, they then also use it for that on the voluntary index basis mainly. But I think there aren't many systems that freely let other departments use this kind of information. And maybe that's why we don't have our fingerprint databases in this country actually accessible to the police. Maybe that's what the kind of thinking. I think it's wrong, but that's where we are. But we can do more research around that and find out on that issue.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister. We will take the last badge of hands. I also say to Comrade Johnny that we will give other stakeholders opportunity when we deliberate after the public hearings. They will be part of the public hearings. We'll give them platform as experts to assist us in this regard. So each and every person who is interested will be given an opportunity to be part of the deliberation. Honorable Sitton, and then Honorable Van Wyk.
Chairperson. Chairperson, one is a question, the other is more a comment, and I think something that we need to think about, and specifically in terms of implementation. The question is, I would like to know the state law advisors in their reasoning around the 5 years, why then the differentiation with minors, when they put the onus on the minor to come back and say, remove my information, and why not, does that not apply that when the child reaches the age of 18 that it immediately gets off the database? I mean, I don't understand their reasoning on the one hand trying to say, keep information but for no longer than 5 years, but then when we get to children, we say, when you become 18, you shall decide whether it should be removed or not. So that's not quite clear to me, especially in light of the Child Justice Bill that has been solved. Again, there's a bigger responsibility put on the child than there is on the adult. The second issue that worries me, or maybe I shouldn't use the word worry, but I think it will be a challenge specifically for SAP. Minister, I mean, in so many instances, we all know that we've got very, very good legislation, but the problem arises with implementation. And I see this as one of those again. And my concern is not so much the unit itself and what they will be doing, because I believe if we put the capacity there, if we allow them to get people, and if we allow them to get professional people, if we pay them enough so that they can keep that capacity, that can be done. My concern is with the rest of the SAPS, the first guy on the scene, your detectors in terms of using this. I'm not worried about the crime scene investigator, because hopefully that person will be the person that knows how to handle these things. And my concern is in terms of the training of SAPS. And somehow, somewhere, and I don't know whether it should be in the bill, but we need to look at that as well. If the first guy that arrives on the scene, and now we're also talking about cooperation between SAPS and private security industry, so the first person on the scene might actually be somebody from the private security industry, is how do we deal with that? And I think we should, if I can think about it, and I'm thinking off the top of my head, if I can make a suggestion, for instance, that we put in somewhere in the bill that the head of this unit will develop a training program that will be implemented at basic training, whatever the case may be, but that there's some sort of provision. The second issue related to this, and you will remember, Chairperson, as Chair of Safety and Security as well, is that for years now, in any case, at least for the past Parliament, SAFs have been telling us we're going to have, and we have in our cars, this immediate identification system, where you can take the guy's fingerprint immediately and identify whether he is a criminal, whether there's outstanding warrants, etc. Now, sorry to say, I still believe it's only in theory. I believe there might be one or two, three or 20 cars in Gauteng. It's not general. It's not all over. And I think, Minister, if this thing's got to work effectively, we need to make sure that technology becomes available to the police throughout the country, that it's something that they have in their car, supposedly, that it's there, because then this becomes effective. And somehow we need to make sure that it actually happens. I see Commissioner Ayers agreeing, because we've been told it's there. We know it's not there, because if it was there, it would have been far more effective, and hopefully our convictions would have been looking better as well. So those are some of the issues. As I say, it's more operational, but that do concern me at this stage.
Honourable Sitton.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, just thinking one of the issues, on the issue of the retention of the 5-year DNA sample, or for 5 years, what would the Deputy Minister think? And I personally don't have a problem with that, let's get that straight. I think it's a good thing in this country. But if we do have a lot of opposition to it, how would the minister feel about us determining that it's only in the case of previous convictions? In other words, if a person is found innocent, but only if you've had previous convictions, that we retain those sort of samples.
Honourable Benji, and then Honourable Matas. Council Chairperson. And afternoon, because I've just joined the committee. But I think I got actually motivated by the input, one of the answers that was coming from the minister, deputy minister. And I want to find out that, Chairperson, you know, knowing SARPS, when you talk of some of the police stations, where they are situated, the environment, some of them you would not even tell that this is a police station. Now I'm looking at the storage of this type of equipment that we're now talking about to say perhaps then also SARPS also needs to check up its facilities and particularly safekeeping of this so that it doesn't just showing the issue of the fires, the way some of the police stations find they don't even have the file register. You know, some of the things when you get there, you know, they don't have the necessary systems. But the thrust of my question, it comes to the question of now sentencing. Shouldn't we also perhaps be bringing in, I am not a legal person, but just concerned to say, you know, South Africans, or yeah, let me admit, South Africans, we end up not having anything that they fear. There's nothing that you know people fear. They say I can kill you, and they do it, and they get away with it. Now I'm trying to think, what kind of a deterrent sentence, if it may perhaps means, if I'm I'm caught up abusing this type of technological, you know, backup system to combat crime, to see how best, you know, not best, but how could, maybe if we were to categorize sentences on the type of an act that people do, that you are found to be abusing the system, or even as a result of that, committing other criminal acts, you know, to what type of a sentence, you know, can we, if it means perhaps then categorizing some of the misbehaviors, you know, such that it, you know, it sends a very clear signal that even I'm thinking of where you'll even be able to say you'll never get a parole if you have been caught on this particular category. I'm just thinking loud, but something that will send a clear signal that this is not something to play around with. You know, and because we're having our visitors, people coming in and out of the country, and even ourselves, people learning some of the tactics, but I'm saying, is it not also saying to us, can we also need, we need to review some of the sentences, perhaps to check them, the years. Because I wouldn't, if I had my way, I would say death penalty. But I know I wouldn't have that. But I'm saying, but something that to me, it will indeed send a clear deterrent to whoever wants to do some of this, so that it curtails the conduct of these wrongdoers. Thank you.
Honorable Madassa.
Thank you, Chairperson. I really don't want to belabor this point, Deputy Minister. It's bothering me, this retention of this information on people who are not suspects. I just think that we are going to face problems. I listened to you very carefully, and your emphasis is on catching criminals. That this kind of information, if kept, it helps to catch criminals, which therefore says to me that already you are making a presumption of criminality on those people. They are likely to commit crimes. Those people, information that we keep. And I think that's precisely where the problem is. This category of people will say, why are they presumed, their information presumed useful to prevent crime? Why their information only is presumed useful to prevent crime, not the rest of the country's people. So I think that's where the
for me, that's where the problem is going to come. That the people will say nothing has been found against us. So why our information is kept to prevent crime? And do you have evidence, in any case, in South Africa, not elsewhere, that by keeping this information, crime has been, crime investigation has been enhanced? I don't think, given the department's evidence, own evidence, that this system has not been in good usage in our country. Therefore, we're starting from a very low base on the usage of the DNA system and so on. Then it follows, therefore, that we don't have evidence to prove that this information would be useful, because we haven't used it extensively before. I don't want to engage in too much academic debate about this. But I just think I'm not comfortable about it.
Thank you, members. Are there any other hands? Because this is the last round of hands. I won't allow a person who's not a member of parliament. There will be time. I will give time for them. But at this moment, I'm only giving to members of parliament. I think everything that has been said, it is an individual opinion of a member. So I think the road is still very much long ahead of us, because they're still going to meet with some other people and take along their views. But at the end of the day, Advocate Madas will have to sit as members of parliament and take decisions. Does not mean that everything that has been said here by Comrade Joni and his team is what we're going to agree upon. We're going to debate these issues, and at the end of the day, we're going to agree on something that we know that it will be benefiting everybody within the country, especially when fighting crime, because our own, or all of us, were aiming at trying to reduce the level of crime in this country. That's what is important. We know that it's not everyone is going to be very happy about what we're doing, but in some instances, we need to be public reps. We need to be public reps. When you are a public rep, you don't have to be popular for some of the issues that we are going to take decision upon. But as long as we know that the majority of this country are going to benefit from what we'll be agreeing upon here, then we take that route. Honorable Delange and your team.
Yeah, I think the last question of Advocate Mandasa, I'm a bit lost in it because you're confusing issues, I think. I think we must be very clear. On the one hand, everywhere in the world, and I say everywhere in the world, it is accepted that the collection of DNA and fingerprints, and some countries go further and they even take cellular samples, is a totally acceptable procedure. They don't even question it, and there's not even a challenge about it around criminality. The only question which arises here is the one of a very small proportion of people. Small, very small. And that is people that do not have previous convictions of any sort, and for the first time have been in conflict with the law and were found to be not guilty. That's the category of person we talk about. It's a very small percentage of them. So I think we must be careful to start saying, as I think you were saying, that, you know, when one started using this these kind of procedures, and those, because it shows we have no other evidence and so on. Well, that's the whole point. The point is, at this stage in this country, we don't have this capacity at all. And most criminals are walking and are not being found. Firstly, we're not finding out who they are. Then, when we investigate them, we not necessarily have this kind of real evidence to actually put them in prison. Now, I think when it comes to all the theoretical debates on it, I really want to urge you to read what the comments of Judge Steiner on this. Because, I can't put it as articulately as he does, and he has done it in a very legal way, by dealing with legitimate aim, proportionality, you know, all the things we as lawyers deal with. Why? And he deals specifically with only with this one aspect, and this is the aspect of why should we keep such samples. I have in any case said, you know, the bigger question we have to ask ourselves is if there is something wrong with keeping, for example, DNA samples, why would we have now for more than 100 years been keeping fingerprint samples? Very accepted practice that started at the turn of the century. DNA started in the 1980s. In fact, DNA is so much more accurate and it's so much more useful than fingerprints. I personally would want to see a day in South Africa that when you get your ID book, they take your fingerprints, they take your DNA and whatever else. And that is what we keep of our citizens. I would want to see a time. So I don't want to just see a time when it's just for the reason for... The problem is we have a particular criminal justice problem to try and now inflate a lot of other good objectives as well. To try, we will then never get this thing done. Because we'll then have to ask Home Affairs, start from scratch, start a DNA structure for us. Which is going to bring me to some of the things you've said very important about implementation. It's a big problem. So I think that all I can say is let's read some of this and let's engage again because I think... You know, I'm not saying that this is not an issue that we shouldn't debate. It is clearly an issue that we should debate. And we should feel comfortable, as the chair says, about this. In the end of the day, you know, I may well be convinced by the committee that, no, this is just not acceptable. We don't want it. We don't need it. And that's fine. Okay. Then we debate that and do it and so on. I'm just putting forward government's point of view at this stage, and that is, let us make it within our constitutional framework. Let's make the tools for police as wide as possible. And if we then err in going too wide at some stage, let the courts tell us about that. And in the meantime, put in checks and balances to try and avoid those kind of abuses you're saying. So I think this will be an ongoing debate. I'm sure you'll have it with others as well. Which also brings me to Ms. Seaton's answer. Of course, if you've got previous conviction and you then later on found not, your DNA will already be in the base database, so it doesn't really matter. The issues of stories of the equipment and so on, the one thing that good thing has happened with the review of the criminal justice system is that the whole investigation aspect of police have got a focus. If you look at the latest budgets of police, they have been getting more money because we've identified a real problem. You know, I mean, after 15 years being involved in this stuff, I was stunned with some of the things I found out. I said this publicly. I was stunned with some of the things I found out, which is either that we've done our priorities wrong or we didn't see where the right priorities were. But the first time, when I started unpacking this stuff, and I said, okay, how does the investigation system work? And I said, okay, I understand they're crime scene investigators. Only crime scene investigators may go onto the crime scene. They've got a whole lot of protocols and things. The law doesn't allow you. Other policemen to do it. Then you look at the detectives, and then you look at forensics. So I said to Pitya, I said, listen, Commissioner, give me a breakdown of this. Let me see what the capacity is. What equipment have you got? And what have you? I mean, I was stunned. Because the first thing he came, he said to me, 1691. So I said, no, I'm not talking about one area. I want to know how many crime scene investigators you have for the whole country. He said, no, 1691. So as I said, I got an F in matric for maths. So I sat there and I thought to myself, 2 million crimes. Assume 1 million of those crimes, at least you need crime scene investigators. Everything to do with violence and so on. And everything to do with dishonesty crimes, theft and so on. Those only have to have crime scene investigators. So I said, but 1,691, you divide it into a million. And you take the amount of time you have available to work, then it must be the best kept secret in this country that the vast majority of crime scenes are never visited by crime scene investigators. Not because they're lazy or whatever. It's physically, it's humanly impossible. So I've had thefts at my house. The policeman comes to the front door, he gives you a form. You say, what do I do with the form? He says, no, it's an insurance form. You say, but are you in the insurance business now? I mean, why are you giving me insurance? Well, I can go to my own insurance company. I want you to go and take fingerprints from it. Oh, do you want fingerprints taken? A week later, the person comes. Now, the reason for that is they got 1,600, maybe sometimes some of them are lazy, but the reason mainly is because they got 1,691, and if you go and look at how many cars they share and how many phones they share, You know, I always tease with detectives. I say, I think it's, is it 9 or 11 detectives share a cell phone? I don't know. It's 7 or 8 people share a cell phone. Can you imagine your phone? Say, hello, this is Sunny van der Spey. I want to report a crime to the detective, van der Merwe. And I say, sorry, Detective van der Merwe is not here at the moment. He's only got the phone in 7 days' time. Please phone in 7 days' time. I'll give it to you. I mean, you can't. I mean, you know, that's what your problem is, you know. So what I'm really saying is all the issues that Ms. Van Baker is raising around implementation. Implementation is our biggest problem. But here we have an advantage. You see, most other pieces of legislation, when you start something, you're starting it from scratch. Now, to start something from scratch in any organization is difficult. But here, we've had fingerprints for a long time. We're now trying to expand and get it done better. So at least we're starting from somewhere. There are some people with experience, there's already some equipment, there's some precedence, you know, there's some protocols and so on. DNA, although a lot of this is new in terms of the law, in practice, if you go, and I actually suggest the committee should actually go one day when they've got time, this, to go and go to their laboratory. It's amazing to see some of the things. I mean, you know, the worst thing, and you raise this or something, when I say to him, I say, okay, there's all this nice stuff here. How many of the police know the capacity you've got here? He says, hardly any. I say, how many prosecutors know of this capacity? Hardly any. How many magistrates and judges know of this capacity? Hardly any. So the issue of training and the publicizing of this and actually working as a criminal justice system is totally non-existent. I will put my head on a block that if you go and take a sample of detectives in this country and you ask them to explain to you what capacity he has got in his laboratory, I will put my head on a block. The vast majority will know basic stuff in them. Would they know, for example, you know this Moodley chap they caught with this woman he killed, that Lee? You know, that guy was found guilty with a half a fingerprint on a rubber glove. Now, if you do not teach crime scene investigators to go and look for every rubber glove, to look for glasses, to look for cups, anything people will leave their body parts on. If you don't train them to do that, and I know that they're not trained to do it fully, and I'll say it openly here. I'll say that. I'll tell you why. When I asked Pete, now give me all your information on what your crime scene investigators collect, the only statistics they keep is on fingerprints. They do not keep any statistics. There is not part of their makeup of their work to keep statistics on actually what it is they collect, for example. So if you've not trained people for the things that are in the laboratory, if you've not trained people up front to say, these are all the kind of things you should be looking for when you go and look at pieces of hairline, like CSI. You know those people, when they go in there, they do all those things with their pink lights and purple and all those things. If you do not do all those things at the crime scene, then there is vast piece of evidence. If you leave there, it's dead, it's gone. It can't be retrieved ever. Now, I know that with 1,691 people, firstly, why do you train them to do that if you know that the vast majority, they cannot do it? So you just let them stick to fingerprinting. That's all you let them really do. You know that the most DNA cases in this country, more than 70% of DNA matters, does not come through the police. It comes from doctors. Doctors with rape cases collect clothing and so on. That 70% of DNA in this country comes via the doctor. It's not part of our work on the crime scene. So we have to change, not only train and implement, we have to change completely. I'm sitting at the moment overseeing the drafting of a protocol. What it is that we want them to do at the crime scene. I have told Mr. Du Toit that you will from now on in all your reports include what other things are collected in the crime scene. Force them to start looking for other things and report so that we can see. We took clothing, we found blood, we did whatever. Because that is not part of their makeup at the moment. There's just too little of them And because they're so little, they concentrate on what is something that's known, which is your fingerprint. And that is why the 93 offices throughout the country that do this stuff, you'll see they do their own fingerprint, they don't send to head office. They do it themselves, yeah. It's because we've concentrated on their work on one area. So when this bill gets passed, there's going to have to be a major shake-up of crime scene investigators to really change their whole job description, to train them differently, so that this capacity of that's going to cost us billions. It's no use paying billions for this equipment. It's going to stand up in Pretoria, and the crime scene investigators are not looking for this evidence. So your points about implementation are vital. I mean, once this bill has been passed, we then have to get the money to set up this, we have to get the equipment, and so on. A lot of it can't even be done in the police. We're looking at how can we outsource the profiling stuff. But I'm not even going into that detail at the moment. It's all part of that. But the fact of the matter is, and then we're going to have to, we are at the moment, one of the things I haven't raised yet, is your retention and your policy of the police. I mean, we're going to have to, as far as I'm concerned, you don't have to be intelligent to work out that there's now 1,850 crime scenes. It's slightly gone up. You don't have to, that has to be, actually go up 4 or 5 times more. Not by 2010, 2011, like now, like yesterday. So, with all these plans of these things, which the things that Mrs. Van Baker, we're going to have to engage with police management, with Treasury, to see how we're going to do this. Because you don't find these kind of people in thin air. I mean, there are ideas that we have, which I'm not going to raise here, and how to try and do some of this. But you're going to have to change drastically that the priorities in the police force are going to have to move to investigation. You know, at the moment, Chair, now I've talked about crime scene investigators, that they don't focus on this, they're not too made for it, they're too little of it. Now the next person that does the work is the detectives. In this country, we've got 21,000 detectives. Work it out. 20,000, 21,000 detectives divided again into the number of crime. Now you're dealing with 2.1 million crimes a year, plus all the crimes that are left over from next year. Those are the detectives, are only 21,000 that deal with it. They share 7-on-7 cell phone, 3 share a computer, 2 of them share a car. Okay? That capacity that we've got. The police, the whole investigation capacity of the police is only 15% of the whole police force. 85% of the police force do other things. Now, I'm not in any way, don't even indirectly say that I'm saying the rest of it's not important. I'm not saying that. But clearly there's a priority problem that if it's crime that we're dealing with, and we have to, and the best deterrent for crime is not sentencing. The best deterrent for crime, anyone will tell you anywhere in the world, including our constitutional court, is the fact that criminal knows that the chances are high they're going to be found out. In this country, we actually, vast numbers of crimes, we don't know who committed them. So sentencing only comes in with those ones that we do know committed them. We've caught them, we've got the evidence, we find them guilty, and we then sentence them. It's a minute number of the real criminals in this country. The real problem we have is we don't even know who they are at the moment. So to fix that up, you have to reprioritize, and in my view, you have to, your investigation areas, these three I've mentioned, have to at least become one-third of your police force, at least one-third in the short term. That's how you must bump up the numbers. You have to double your number of detectives. Your forensic people, you have to double and even more. Your crime scene, you have to 4 or 5 times increase. So on all these issues of implementation, I want you, and the Parliament must help us, we have to engage as a country with the police, but with everyone we have to engage, that these priorities have to be rechanged. You know, I know that the big argument is around visible policing and so on, but visible policing is something that works in democracies where there's stability. Where you're fighting to find out who the criminals are and put them away, your priority has to be to catch those criminals. And the deterrent has to be that the vast majority of criminals know that ultimately we're going to find out who they are, we're going to gather legitimate evidence on them, and we're going to put them away. That is what helps. Then we can look at sentencing and all the other things. But these guys that are not scared of sentencing, they're not really not scared of the sentencing. They're not,
They're not scared because they know they will never actually be caught. That's what their problem is at the moment. And I think that is why this legislation will help us with all those priorities. It doesn't take them away, because this just allows us to create the legal framework to give the police the tools. We then have to reprioritize. And in the Act, we have got a clause on training which says the Commissioner of Police, maybe we must say in consultation with the division, must create a training program that's appropriate, blah, 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 and even, you know, come and report to Parliament, hopefully, all that type of stuff. Because if we don't do that, we're going to spend billions of rand, but we're going to sit with the same amount of people. So all the things you've said, I agree with 100%. I want to add even some of the things to it. That is how the issues are, is that within our police, we have to start looking at how we reprioritize investigations. And once we build there, and I've always said to people, that becomes our deterrent. Because the more criminals know that we're actually going to start catching them, the police are good enough to catch them, the easier it makes for the rest of the police force to operate. Because they operate on that basis, if you want to do that. So I think that this is only the starting of a really big process, which hopefully will be partners, government and the committee, in trying to make sure that these things get implemented. The issues you raise about the cars. I mean, I don't even want to give an input here today. One of the other things that stunned me is that we have a lot of information in the system, but it's totally fragmented and it's geared towards all different types of things. That's why I rely on statistics, Chair, because I think they're useful too. But I'm very careful of our statistics. Not because I think, for example, our crime scene statistics actually, I think, is an accurate reflection of crime that's reported. But the problem is no one looks at what happens to that statistic afterwards. The whole criminal justice review, that's what it does. What do we as a country do once the crime has been committed? One of the issues I raised with you is the vast majority of crime. It's reported on over the weekend. By the week, you start withdrawing. None of our statistics show that a vast majority of those cases are almost withdrawn within a week of the cases being. Sometimes they're left longer, so you investigate, then people come and say, no, I don't want to go with that. Money is wasted. Now, we have no statistics in this country whatsoever to show us what's really happening once the crime has been committed and reported. We've got nothing after that. We've got bits and pieces. You've got the crime scene people will keep their statistics. Pete gives me his. Forensic keep theirs. Detectives keep theirs. Each problem separately. And that's another fragmentation. Then the prosecutors, then the social development. Yeah, each one keeps it separate. They don't speak to each other. If you ask me, explain to us what happened to murders that happened 3 years ago. I cannot. No one in this country can explain to you what has happened to those murders. No one can say to you, so many the people didn't want to go ahead with the case. So many we didn't find who the perpetrator was. If you want that information, I will have to send a team of thousands of people into each unit to physically go and do a manual audit to go and check each and every case, try and link it up in the next unit, Then start with the next case, 19,000 of them. You'll have to do like that. We do not have a criminal justice system database. So these issues you're raising about the cars and so on, the problem is, one of the issues is, we've got some good ideas. The police have got some, not more system than that, are some good ideas. The problem with it is, they're all in a vacuum. This unit deals with this unit. They don't have a criminal justice system database that can link it up so we can use these things effectively. So what we have said is, and Cabinet has now, on the 3rd of December, adopted a single plan for a database for the whole criminal justice. The first time in the history of this country that has been done. What we had to do is put all the departments together for weeks, go and sit down and go and look at all the information we need and agree. They agreed on 28 KPIs, which will be the top end of the system. Then they've agreed with 200 KPIs under that. So there's a whole system with all the information. Once we put that in place, we can then put on top of that a national database, because you'll still have these individual bases, but they'll be linked. and a national database that can give you the analysis. And we'll, for the first time in this country, have legitimate analysis of all the information. We'll know how many cases are reported, how many are immediately withdrawn, the other cases, why are they withdrawn, why don't we find out, what are the reasons. Those things are not kept today by the police. It's not part of the information they keep. So all those things, and we're now trying to link them up. Once we've got that, then we can push for money for those other kind of systems, you, which are very good ones, but in the moment they work in a vacuum. There's a whole lot of programs I've got with PIT, for example. You know, your SAP 69 takes weeks sometimes for the courts to get hold of it. We're trying to find a way to, with, if we get the database going, how we can then, just by a press of the button, have all courts and prosecutors have access to his SAP 69, so that today if you arrest, you arrest Fatima. You immediately can put in the system and say what other crimes she's got. At the moment, we pick up someone for drunk, well, not drunken driving, for driving without a license. Driving without a license, you think, okay, well, it's not so serious. Meantime, the person who is the driver of that is the main gang boss in a gang. We don't pick it up that he's being looked for. So all these things that you're raising is, once we put these things in place, with the IT system, it will help us with those systems of yours as well. And we can then, as government, very strongly, and particularly the review, we've already said we will then strongly support the police to get those. But we are hesitant at the moment to get those things without the database, because it's a vacuum in which they're operating. I think that's most of it. Then just to also say on the one thing, as I said, since we've been engaging with these matters, he is now building a few empires for himself. You're building one in Durban?
No, one in Durban.
We've got the site. We're going out on tender. Cape Town? Busy building. Pretoria finished? The site is finished. And Joburg? P. And upgrades in P. So all the things you're raising about their facilities, they've been getting money. They're creating their sites to make sure that this type of work and the equipment that we're talking about is properly kept and properly. Because once this act is passed, they must have all those capacities to be able to do it. And part of it is already they're building those buildings. So I must just say there is some work that already is being done to make sure that they secure. I hope those are all the issues. Oh, children. Look, the children issue, as I said, for me is a very minor issue. Whatever way we want to do it, we can do it. I mean, the fact of the matter is it only affects the voluntary index. So it's only those cases where parents have felt that their children should be on the index, exactly because if they get missing and so on, there's something that you can trace them by. So whatever method we want to create, that when they reach 21 now, they say, I personally couldn't care. I mean, for me, it's an issue that's a benefit for people. And they should actually be on it and not on it. And if they want to remove themselves, that's fine. And how they do it, or whether we should initiate it, or they, I mean, you guys can decide on that. For me, it's not a very big issue. Yeah, no, I mean, and we must understand that, I mean, if children have committed crimes, they're on the database.
Yeah, okay.
But they're on the other database.
Yeah.
This is just the voluntary one. Yeah, you check the voluntary, yeah. So that is why they say then the child should have their own decision whether they want to stay on there, because it means that they can be checked as well. And then that's the reason they want to say that they should at least as a child have a choice on 21 years old whether to stay on there or not. I hope that's all the questions.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister. I think you really tried to respond to most of the questions that has been raised by members. As I have said, that there is a lot that this actual committee need to be engaged in. And on the issue of the forensic lab, I said, you said there is one in the Western Cape. Did I hear that?
Yeah, they have a lab here, and they're also building one. You've got people here already in the old lab.
Yeah. And maybe during the course of the deliberations on this bill, we will have to pay a visit there as the ad hoc committee. I will just have to look at the program that we are going to decide upon immediately after this, and then see which is the relevant week for us to go there, even if it's for a half day.
Maybe you should just engage Mr. De Toy on it, because the better lab is Pretoria. It has the more sophisticated DNA stuff.
Right.
The one here has got only got a basic DNA stuff.
All right.
But you can engage.
No, it's fine. We'll do that. But I thought it would be really probable if members of the adult committee could see what is it that you're talking about. And I agree with you on some of the issues that you raised when it comes to what the police are doing in reality. Because the weakest part of SAPS is when it comes to communication. They can't market themselves. They are doing a very good job. When we were disbanding the Scorpion, I went to the organized unit of SAPS in Pretoria. Things that I discovered that the police are doing, I never knew that they were doing those things. I joined this portfolio in 1999. I never knew that they were doing such a good job, the police, when it comes to organized crime. Hence, we said that they will be able then to do what the DSO was doing. And then I think to members of parliament, I will communicate with members then for the next meeting, when the next meeting is, because from now we have to advertise for people to send in their comments, and then after which then we'll have to meet again. But during that process, I think we will meet, but I will discuss that with Jeremy when we leave this place. And after the finger lunch is ready outside.
Well,
thank you very much.
Yeah.